Hello, and welcome to a bonus episode of the Ididapod, a podcast about, thank God, sled dogs and mushing. I'm Zachariah Hughes, a reporter at Alaska Public Media, and until recently was out on the trail covering the race. You are hearing that correctly. I am not our usual host, Casey Grove. I am merely filling in to deliver some bonus pod content, sort of like a substitute chemistry teacher you should feel free to ignore or play practical jokes on. Now that the race is over and we're all grappling with a big, scary new problem affecting each of our lives, we thought it would be a good time to take a breath, take stock, and look back at some of the sled dog adjacent stories we did not have time for in the frenzy of the Iditarod. So today, we're bringing you an interview I did with veteran long-distance musher Catherine Keith. She's written a new book called Epic Solitude. Follows her journey from a teenager in Minnesota, falling in love with rugged wilderness adventures, while simultaneously struggling with debilitating mental health issues, overcoming childhood abuse, and more loss than anyone should have to deal with in a lifetime. Throughout the book, Keith jumps backwards and forwards in time, recounting her early sled dog races in Western Alaska and the Iditarod. It's a lively, intimate work, touching on tragedy, perseverance, and spiritual growth, and spanning the continent. From treks in California, a peyote ceremony in the desert, to Arctic compounds miles outside of Kotzebue. I spoke with her just as the book was about to come out, and here is that conversation. Catherine Keith, welcome, and thank you so much for coming in to talk about your book.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
This book touches on a lot of different parts of your life. I'm curious, as you were writing about it and telling people that you were writing it, how did you explain it to people?
I like to describe it as a book that oscillates between epic adventures and raw life. And I wrote it that way very intentionally because everyone loves this very fun adventure stories. They're great to read about. They keep you on the edge of your seats. They help as page turners and they get you to the end of the story. But the point of the book was to provide depth and meaning as to some very important aspects about life itself. And that's where the memoir aspect of the book comes in. Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, why did you want to write it?
Writing this book was something that's been in the back of my mind for many, many years. Going through life, everyone experiences loss of some form. For me, it was a loss of my husband and my child when she was 1 month old. And also, I experienced a lot of trauma in my teenage years. And those are something that are common. And the stages of loss can vary, but inevitably, they start with shock. And once you get through that, you experience numbness. And then sometimes that can go on for weeks or years even. But the important thing is at some point we have to engage with life fully again. And for me, that didn't happen for years. But my way of coming back to the surface was through adventure and through the wilderness and through solitude, through the Iditarod and through hiking the Pacific Crest Trail. And in the writing of this memoir, I wanted to share that with other people. And my way was through these adventures, but everyone else is going to have their own way.
There was a lot of stuff in the book that was not about mushing. I'm wondering, can you just tell me about the bus that you drove up to Alaska? Because that was a detail that I was really tickled by.
I was, as a child, dreamed of coming to Alaska. When I was 21, it was time to go. So I had $500 in my pocket, not much more than that. And my dad helped me purchase a short bus that had been converted into an ice cream truck. It was painted white, and on top of that, it had stickers all over it of ice cream and Pokemon stickers, and the horn played music to attract kids to come and buy ice cream, and it got 8 miles to the gallon. It probably looked like a highly suspicious vehicle, assuming that there were drugs inside of it. So, which there were not, for the record.
So you get into Alaska, and then you go straight to Seward, and you quickly get a job as a kayaking tour guide. You didn't lie, but you were not totally candid about your experience sea kayaking. Tell me about how you convinced a stranger to give you a job where you were responsible for other people in a large body of water.
For anyone that's been to Seward, you can picture the roads there. And I was running on fumes. I had no money. I got to the end of Lowell Point, and that was it. I had parked the car, and I wasn't going to get any further. So I found the kayak facility there, and I got out and said, I need a job, and I would like to be a kayak tour guide. And the nice elderly gentleman who owned the establishment said, okay, do you know how to kayak? And honestly, how difficult can it be? So I said, yes, I know how to kayak. I could definitely lead tours. And so he said, well, excellent. Let's get out there and show me what you can do. So we both went out and got into the kayaks. And I definitely would have fumbled. He asked me to, I put on the life jacket. He handed me a kayak skirt. Do you do with that? How do you put that on? I tried, got in, and off we went. And Resurrection Bay is one of the most gorgeous places in Alaska. It's magical. For me, whether or not I got the job, it was a brilliant, mystical experience to be out there. So it was a gift. We had a great time. We got back. And I was so grateful and happy. He probably figured I would figure it out eventually. So he gave me the job.
You work for a couple of months taking tourists on sea kayaking tours. And then you get a job on a glacier with tourists who are using a helicopter to get out there and then going on these 30-minute sled dog tours. Was that also your first time on a dog sled?
Yep, that was the first time. Yeah, and immediately it was love at first sight.
And you are in a coffee shop, and tell me about the notice that you saw on the job board that seems like, it's fair to say, changed your life pretty much forever at that point.
It was a very simple notice. Help wanted, room and board, above the Arctic Circle, be a dog handler. No experience required, call this number.
I'm curious what that conversation was like.
Looking back on that conversation now as a Iditarod dog musher myself, enthusiasm goes a long way on these phone calls. And I was extremely enthusiastic, hungry for new experiences, desperate to get out to rural Alaska, wanting to learn, willing to work very hard, not really caring for money. I would have jumped on that airplane tomorrow. And basically, that's what happened. I just needed to sell the bus, get to Anchorage, and that was a done deal. So they agreed to make it happen.
And, you know, you make clear in the book, you're clearly adventurous, you're self-sufficient, you've already been through a lot of stuff at that point, but you're still like 21. And it's one thing to drive to Seward kind of on a whim, and it's got to be another not just to, you know, go out sight unseen to a rural Alaska town of less than 3,000, but the place where you're going to stay is, you know, an additional 24 miles out of town, off the grid, just a compound in some of the most beautiful but difficult wilderness in the world. And I'm curious, when you landed in Kotzebue and were getting ferried out to their place, what was going through your head?
It was exactly the adventure I was looking for next. I got off the airplane. Somebody had picked me up. We got in a little tiny skiff, and it was in the fall at that point, so we could hop in a boat. And off we went in a very long boat ride out on the beach. We hiked on the tundra for 3.5 miles to get back to their house and found their cabin.
Was there a moment where you were like, what have I gotten myself into? Maybe around 2.5 miles of marching through the tundra with strangers after hours of a boat journey?
Really, to be honest, no. That's in general, my approach to life when I am faced with a bizarre situation that I haven't seen before, that's when I say, awesome. I've never seen this before. This is great. How often are you able to experience that?
That reminds me of a very different point a little bit earlier in your book where you, would you just describe what your 21st birthday was like?
Oh, yeah, that is a long story. My birthday is normally quite unique. Something always very random would happen on my birthday, and that was no exception. My 21st birthday was not full of drinking or partying. In fact, it was in the deserts in New Mexico and sitting around a drum circle in the middle of a Sundance ceremony and beating drums in the middle of the Leonid meteor shower. And then also the peyote ceremony was happening. And there's just a lot of ways to understand the way that our universe works and experience the sacredness of it all. And it was a very magical birthday.
Had you done hallucinogenic drugs before, or was that just a first and you were open to it?
That was first, that was the last. I believe it's never important to be on hallucinogenics or any drugs ever to experience the divine or the sacred or to connect with any sort of spirits or higher self, anything. There's many ways to do that. It's nothing that I need, but at that time, in that moment, and in that sacred space, it was something that you did as part of that situation.
You have all these moments where it's oscillating between extreme tragedy and grief, and then just rhapsody and joy and spiritual connectedness. And I guess that 21st birthday to me seemed like a contrast to just a couple of months earlier, a kind of low. And I just want to give a little bit of context. It's, you know, 1999, you're barely an adult. You're back in Minnesota, recently divorced from a short, intense marriage that did not work out. You're getting ready to hike the Pacific Coast Trail. And you write that you're so broke that you were selling your plasma twice a week just to afford supplies for this trip. And I wonder, can you just tell me a little bit about what that period was like internally for you?
That was a very difficult time. I was between the ages of 16 and 19. All of those years were so hard. And to put that in comparison, I was very much an overachiever going through my high school years. Straight A's. I was going on to probably an Ivy League school. I was varsity athlete. And that goes to show you that what happens in your childhood, you know, really, really can break you down. Beneath the surface, I was struggling with mental illness. I was struggling with eating disorders. And all of that had been attributed to abuse that I had experienced as a child that didn't come out until years later. And I never understood why. So when I was an older teenager going through 17 and 19, it affected my marriage that had broken down. So coming back from that, there was a lot of devastation. It was going from job to job and barely affording food and donating plasma and trying to get by, trying to understand what happened and where life was even going without knowing what happened was a very confusing time. I did have to purposely find a way to get through that. For me, it was intentionally getting through to the Pacific Crest Trail and finding my way because I needed wilderness, I needed solitude, and I needed to purposely generate grit in order to make that conscious change in my life.
You have a lot of journal entries in this book. They start chapters, they're interspersed throughout. You even include a very personal letter that you wrote to your sisters at a pretty low point. And I'm curious, have you always journaled? Have you always written for yourself and saved it?
I started writing when I was 14. I would fill notebooks once a week, those nothing fancy, but the 25-cent notebooks that you can get at Walmart. Almost obsessively, I would write in these things, and sometimes I could even read what I wrote. The letter that you're referring to my sisters, was put in there because in this state in particular, there's high rates of suicide. And I've worked particularly hard to create programs and work on suicide prevention programs. My stepson, a couple years ago, committed suicide. We have to be real about suicide. There is nothing on the surface level about suicide. So when I talk about suicide in the book, I cannot be surface level about it. That would do a disservice to myself, to Alan, my stepson, and to anyone else that struggled with this or lost somebody in the book. So that's the reason for including that letter. It's more of a tribute.
Was writing this book the first time that you read back through a lot of those entries?
Yeah. Yeah, they were pretty ugly. There's a lot of stuff I didn't include.
There's a section in the book about you running the Kuskokwim 300 as you're getting ready to, you know, qualify for the Iditarod. And you write, you're having a conversation with your mom on the phone, and you tell her, "Mom, I don't understand why I'm out here. I mean, why the heck do people run this? I don't get it. It's horrible. Why did I sign up for this? I will never race again. We will be in last place. The dogs hate me by now." Do you have a moment like that with every race?
I do, actually. Not sure if other mushers experience this. It's at a point where you get so fatigued. It's usually 3 or 4 days into the race in Iditarod or the Yukon Quest. And you're not yet trail hardened. And you start to wonder, man, what? This doesn't make any sense. Why would anybody do this? What is going on? Then what happens is you look around you and the scenery is stunning. You go up to your leaders and they're absolutely in love with you and they're having a blast. The stars are sparkling and then the northern lights come out. Then you realize, oh, yeah, that's why I'm doing this. And then you start to get in your groove and you realize you're in love with what you're doing. And that's why you're out here. So that moment doesn't usually last. What I've learned is when you hit those lows in triathlons, you call them bonking. But what's important is the generation of grit. That's when you just need to take one foot in front of the other. You can't quit. You just shut off your mind. You don't get into a panic mode. You don't act on your negative thinking. You just calm down, take a breath, one foot in front of the other, one foot in front of the other. You just act. And it is somewhat cliche to say that, but that is what you do when you're out there on the trail, and it carries back over into life too, because we get into that similar mindset when we're at work or when we're at home. You know, what is going on? Why are we doing this? Why are we studying for this exam? Or why am I in this job? I hate it. Why am I struggling to save up money? I can't do this. I'm broke. But sometimes you just have to stay the course one step at a time, and you do get where you're going, and it is worthwhile if you just take a breath, keep going. And that's what generates the resilience that you need.
It flashes forward in the book. It's your first Iditarod, and it was the 2014 Iditarod, which is, I think, fair to say, gone down in record as the worst trail in years, if not the race's history. But it was your rookie run, so you didn't know any better. And I'm curious if you can just describe some of the more heroic measures you needed to get your sled through the Dalzell Gorge, down the Burn, and into Nikolai.
The last checkpoint to get going on the trail, the checker said, yeah, everybody's kind of breaking sleds and there's injuries. I'm not sure you want to go. Like, what? Of course we're going to go. You know, it's beautiful. So I was kind of nervous, but we take off. And going through the gorge, yeah, it was a heck of a ride. It was nonstop, hanging on the whole time, falling over left and right, hitting trees. There's ice everywhere you go. Dogs are slipping, but nobody got hurt. One of my dogs, Joy, her tug line broke and she got loose. And then behind me was Dallas. And I couldn't stop to get her, but Dallas was able to...
This is Dallas Seavey, who ended up winning that year.
Yeah, Dallas Seavey was able to grab her, put her in his team, and meet me down the trail. So I had her again. And anyway, it was just nonstop excitement. There was like adrenaline the whole time. And on we went, and super fast. Just you're on the whole time. And as we get into Roan, and I shouted both arms up at the same time, that was awesome. And I had a great time. It was just because it was a wild ride. It was like being at a major theme park. And the sled was broken. I was all bruised, but I didn't get severely hurt like some of the other mushers. So we were lucky.
And so your sled continues to deteriorate. You're using wire to try and hold it together, but every few hundred yards or miles, it's breaking apart. And then in Nikolai, yeah, you get gifted what seems like a luxury sled, right?
Yeah. 5 miles outside of Roan, we hit a tree and completely demolished the sled. The sled went smack into the center of the tree, completely unusable at that point. So I had to do all sorts of jerry-rigging. And we half rode, half walked the sled the rest of the way, which was a long way over sand and snow. And thankfully Martin Boozer had a spare sled that he allowed us to use. And it was a very unique sled, all plastic, very ingenious. Thanks, Martin.
So you're in your mid-20s, and you've met your husband, your partner, Dave, and you're pregnant for the first time as you guys are living out there. And I was wondering if you would mind reading this selection from that period, because I think it'll be something that a lot of Alaskans will relate to.
Sure. Up to 7 months pregnant, I practice yoga, standing on my head daily. It is hard to no longer act like one of the guys. I can't drink coffee or whiskey or go out on rough boat rides. I don't quite enjoy being pregnant, despite my excitement about being a mom. Worse than that is being subjected to the impracticality of maternity clothes. I should write to Carhartt and ask them to launch a line of maternity work gear. Those flimsy stretch leggings paired with one of those awful butt-covering cutesy dress shirts will not cut it while fishing for salmon, building a greenhouse, or working in the woodlot. Pregnant Alaskans work and need the comfort and practicality of durable gear.
Thank you. Was it hard to write? I mean, your first daughter died at about a month old. Was that difficult to write about and share? I mean, you make it clear in the book that it was extremely painful at the time, but was it a hard decision for you to decide to put that out into the world?
It was a must to write about because the message was the fragility of life, how we can take things for granted. When I was 22 years old, I had no idea that babies could die. Who knew that babies could die? I was clueless. I treated her as if it was a guarantee she would be with me forever. Writing that piece was important for that reason. We need to cherish life. That story is intended to really carry that impact of just how critical it is to treat life for what it is. Now, regarding how difficult it was to write that and the impact that had, it was very difficult. I don't believe I recovered from writing that section for a long time. You know, I'm talking months, you know, losing people in our lives. You don't recover from it. You don't ever heal from it, but you do learn how to cope and you do learn how to manage that better. So I do feel I have learned to manage that better. For example, I'm talking about it right now. I'm not shaking. I'm not crying. I'm not going to have nightmares about it tonight. So that in itself would not have happened a year ago.
So I wonder how your second pregnancy compared to your first.
When I was pregnant with Amelia, I was scared the entire time, to be honest. That being said, I was much more cautious, knowing that at any time things could go wrong. Being pregnant saved me, gave me hope again, gave me a chance, a second chance at life again. But I was very, very afraid.
You are away with your daughter Amelia. How old is she now?
She's 16.
Okay. You're with her out of state, and your husband, who you write about in just the most loving and glowing terms of falling in love with at first sight, goes missing during a medical emergency where he's helping out a neighbor. And by the time you get back, it's been some time that's gone by, and I wonder what it was like walking into your home with your young daughter for the first time when you were back after he went missing.
He went missing on Thanksgiving, mostly because it was freeze up. We went out with snow machines. It was my sister, myself, my daughter, Amelia, who was a month and a half at that time. We went home and the house was froze, yet needed to get the stoves going and figure out what to do next. Everything was left outside, his things everywhere, like a bachelor would have, because we were out of state visiting his family. It was just heartbreaking, unsure of what to do. The generator was left outside, wouldn't start. Chainsaw was outside, wouldn't start. Amelia was crying. She was cold. All the food was frozen. The water was frozen. It had snowed and everything was buried. Couldn't find anything. And not only was he gone, but I was at a loss as to how to start. So I had to break down the sequence of what to do first, and knowing that this was going to be the life now moving forward was me being in charge, taking care of Amelia and I on our own, and this started now.
What gives you joy now?
Everything gives me joy. I have a lot of joy in my life. Amelia, number one, gives me joy. She is the love of my life. Well, I have a lot of loves in my life, but she is awesome. She's smart and very capable. Wonderful, wonderful girl. Being in the wilderness fills me with joy. The dogs fill me with joy. They every time they look at you with that unconditional love and jump up on you, and they do smile.
So right now you don't have a dog team. Are you taking a break from mushing, or is this permanent? Where does dog handling fall for you right now?
Yeah, starting this year, I'm taking a break from Iditarod and the quest. For the past couple of years, I've been working towards climbing the seven summits. Then I'll come back into this sport of dog mushing in 3 years, maybe two, but likely 3 years, depending on the success of the expeditions.
you have a lot of music lyrics in here, everything from Hobo Jim to Merle Haggard and other stuff. Do you listen to music when you're mushing? I mean, do you have earbuds or headphones when you're out?
Yeah, I listen to music. I feel it helps elevate the mood. And I love to sing out loud. I also feel that helps elevate the mood when needed. Also, I love dancing on the sled. It keeps me warm and keeps me super happy. It might not help with speed because it doesn't allow the runners to keep even on the snow. I have a great time out there.
Well, Catherine Keith, I want to thank you so much, not just for speaking with me, but for this book. I could not put it down. Catherine Keith's new book is Epic Solitude. You can get it online wherever books are sold. Catherine Keith, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
That was me, Zachariah Hughes, talking with Catherine Keith about her new book, Epic Solitude. You've been listening to a bonus episode of the Ididapod. We're hoping to have another episode out relatively soon, rounding up all the events, misadventures, and conclusions at the tail end of this year's race. So be sure to check your pod feeds. And happy trails.